This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Aaron Sorkin, is the creator and writer of the new HBO series The Newsroom, set in a fictional cable news network. Sorkin's been known for his verbal fireworks ever since he wrote Jack Nicholson's famous line in A Few Good Men, "You can't handle the truth." Probably a lot of people who've worked in the White House over the years wish they could speak with the eloquence and rapid-fire wit of Sorkin's characters on the series The West Wing, which he also created. Sorkin won an Oscar for his screenplay for The Social Network and co-wrote the film adaptation of the book Moneyball. Terry spoke with Aaron Sorkin last Monday. The Newsroom stars Jeff Daniels as Will McAvoy, a cable news anchor who gives up his straight-down-the-middle approach for a more hard-hitting show that will, as his producer says, speak truth to stupid. The Newsroom is set in the recent past and draws on real news events, but the characters are fictional. In this scene, during the 2010 midterm election campaigns, Will McAvoy interviews two leaders of the fictional group the Riley County Tea Party Express. We've edited this scene for clarity.
You describe the Tea Party as a grassroots movement, right?
Absolutely. We have no central control, no traditional power structure, and that is something that seems to confound the media.
I'm sorry?
That's what confounds the media. It's what the media doesn't get. We are not being run by a George Soros type figure. We are we the people.
Where does your funding come from?
What little funding we have comes from private citizens who mail in $5, $10, $1, whatever they can spare.
Okay, have either of you ever heard the name David Koch?
I'm sorry?
David Koch.
No.
Have you ever heard the name Charles Koch?
No.
Have you ever heard the name Koch Industries?
Are you talking about Coca-Cola?
K-O-C-H. Have either of you heard of Koch Industries?
No.
I think that very soon you will. Koch Industries is the second largest private company in the country, bigger than Coca-Cola. And the Koch brothers' personal wealth of $50 billion is exceeded only by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, and they could buy and sell George Soros 10 times over. They own dozens of companies and industries, including oil and gas, refining and chemicals, minerals, fertilizer, forestry polymers, and fibers, and ranching. You two both attended the Texas Defending the American Dream Summit over the July 4th week?
Yes.
That summit was paid for entirely by Americans for Prosperity, AFP, which has two founders, David and Charles Koch. In the last 6 months, they bankrolled Tea Party candidates in excess of $40 million. Cheryl, Mike, are the Koch brothers average Americans whose voices are being drowned out by lobbyists and special interests? I'm confounded.
Aaron Sorkin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
I've got to say, I'm really enjoying the show. It's like so much fun to me to watch a series where there's drama about booking guests and conducting interviews. So what about you? Why did you want to like set a show in a newsroom?
I like writing idealistically and romantically. And if you can do that in a place that's usually looked at cynically, the way journalism is now, you can get something fun out of it.
So in this interview that you and I are doing right now, I get to ask the questions, you get to give the answers. In the interview clip that we just heard from the newsroom, you got to write the questions and the answers.
That's like, the great part about being a writer. You get to decide what everybody says.
So tell me how you wrote that interview.
What I did with that interview, which is what I do with every interview like that on the show. First of all, I just want to make it clear, real people don't make cameos on the show. They only appear when they're in news footage. And, you know, we'll roll tape of plenty of real interviews and real statements. When I'm making up a person in order to represent people, for instance, those two people in that clip, they're from the Riley County Tea Party Express, which is fictional. What I do is I look at a ton of interviews with Tea Party people that were conducted, and I try to, as fairly as I can, take their answers to questions. And then what I'll do is I'll have Will ask the follow-up that I thought was never asked. In the episode a week ago, which is the episode where that scene took place, in episode 3, Sam Waterston's character tells us that the idea is that Will is a fantastic prosecutor and that they're going to harness that strength, and that the studio is going to become a courtroom, and that he's going to treat guests like they're witnesses on a stand. And I like that because I like writing courtroom drama.
Right. So I know you know Keith Olbermann, and that Sports Night was inspired by the show Olbermann used to co-anchor, SportsCenter. And a lot of people assume that he's one of the inspirations for your new show, which you've denied. You also know Lawrence O'Donnell because he used to be a consultant, right, on the West Wing, and he anchors a show on MSNBC. So how much time did you spend at MSNBC in doing the research for your new series?
I've met Keith Olbermann. I don't know Keith Olbermann. We've met twice. Once Sports Night was on the air, I got a call from him asking if he could visit the set. And that was the first time I met him. And the second time I met him was when he was really gracious. He allowed me to hang out at MSNBC when he was the host of Countdown for a couple of days. And I just spent time being a fly on the wall, mostly speaking with junior staffers, because I knew, or I wanted there to be, I didn't know much about the show at the time, but I wanted there to be a sort of upstairs-downstairs feel and focus on some of the younger people. I do know Lawrence. I worked with Lawrence for several years on the West Wing, where he was on the writing staff, and he made some fantastic contributions. If you have a favorite moment of the West Wing, chances are Lawrence was involved with it.
So what did you learn from spending about 2 days at Countdown with Keith Olbermann that you were able
Nothing,
to use on
but
the
that is where I got the idea for the show. No, I mean it. I was in the procrastinating stage. You know, all I knew was that I wanted to do a show set in a newsroom, and I didn't know anything more than that. And my big worry was making up the news, writing fictional news, that it was just going to take us too far away from reality. And I didn't want to have to make up news events, make up an earthquake someplace, make up an assassination attempt, make up a stock market crash, that kind of thing. But I was sitting at Countdown, and I was on my second day there kind of despairing because I was about to give up on the idea. But while I was thinking that, I was staring at a monitor, and the monitor was showing, I don't know if you remember the spill cam. It was an underwater camera attached to BP Deepwater Horizon. It could show you 24 hours the oil spilling out of there. And this was day 55 of the oil spill. And I was sitting there staring at it, and that's when I got the idea that I could set the show in the recent past. Now, originally all that was something that solved the problem that I was having. Here's how you don't make up the news, set the show in the recent past. But it's sort of a gift that kept giving because you have the fun of the audience knowing more than the characters do. In the pilot episode, for instance, when they get the news about 2/3 of the way through that there's been this explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, the audience wants to shout at the screen, this is a real story, take this seriously, I know what the end of this is going to be. I know that this device, the dramatic device of setting the show in the recent past, has bothered some people, particularly people in the news, who think that I'm leveraging hindsight into a way to make my characters smarter. That wasn't the idea.
And smarter than their newsroom, because like in the BP oil spill, it takes your characters like 15 minutes to figure out things that I think took a lot longer in real life.
Yeah, in real life, it took 2 days for everyone to understand that this was an environmental disaster and not a search and rescue mission. And I'm glad you brought that up, because my intention in the pilot was not to say, gee, if only real news people were as smart as my guys,
exactly, right,
they would have figured this out in 15 minutes. There was a remarkable coincidence that happened to one of my fictional characters, a brand new guy, had a college roommate who was an engineer for BP and a sister who worked for Halliburton, both of whom were willing to whistleblow within 5 minutes of each other.
Which I can only say, what are the odds?
What are the odds? Odds indeed. But I shine a pretty big light on that. When you're writing and you want to use something that is unlikely, the way to do that is to fly in the teeth of its unlikeliness, okay? To not try to get away with it, but to shine a light on it. For instance, in the pilot, we shine a light on that coincidence. Will, Jeff Daniels' character, says, you're telling me you got not one, but two sources to roll over on their employer within 5 minutes of each other? In other words, we admit that it's an unlikely coincidence. That is not a moment that's there to show up other news organizations for not getting there for another 48 hours. They didn't get to have that fictional coincidence.
They didn't have you writing reality.
Exactly right. They didn't have me writing the other part. I'm aware that I get to control everything that happens in my universe and in my fictional universe. And in real life, people don't get to control anything that happens.
So I want to play another scene from the newsroom. And the backstory is that at a New Year's Eve office party at the newsroom, the anchor, Jeff Daniels, was flirting with a woman who he doesn't know, who turns out to be a feature writer for a gossip magazine called TMI. And she is writing what is called a takedown piece, a piece in which you take down a celebrity by revealing, you know, embarrassing things about them. And McAvoy has given her a lecture about why this work she does is reprehensible. And the encounter ends with her throwing her glass of wine or champagne in his face. And so this ends up in the New York Post gossip column, page 6. And in this scene, the cable channel's vice president for news, Charlie Skinner, played by Sam Waterston, calls in the anchor, Will McAvoy, played by Jeff Daniels, and the vice president for news starts reading the anchor what's been printed about him in the New York Post.
Right.
ACN's newly minted liberal bloviator made a scene at a private New Year's Eve party at which our spies caught the re-engineered lefty firebrand making a drunken pass at TMI reporter Nina Howard.
Whoa, Nellie.
But the Tea Party foe got a face full of bubbly instead of what he was looking for. McAvoy was wearing a $4,000 custom-made tuxedo and a dumb look on his face.
There are a couple of factual errors in that story.
Please let there be more than a couple.
First of all, I'm a registered Republican. I only seem liberal because I believe that hurricanes are caused by high barometric pressure and not gay marriage. Second, I wasn't making a pass at her. I was rejecting a pass from her while trying to talk her out of doing what they call at TMI, a takedown piece of one of the desperate housewives in New Jersey.
Real housewives.
Who gives a
Definitely not me.
And the tuxedo's off the rack.
Did you grope her?
No! I gently touched her to block her as she was coming in for a kiss. I blocked her. I was the victim of an unwanted sexual advance. But more important, I was fighting the good fight.
Why were you fighting any fight?
I was trying to get her to not write the takedown piece.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. Because I'm on a mission to civilize.
How's it going so far?
Progress is slow, but I'm in it for the long haul.
Okay, so that's a scene from the newsroom. My guest Aaron Sorkin writes the series, and he created this new HBO series. So the really funny line in there about how you say it about the global warming line, you repeat it for us? You know it by heart.
Sure, I'm a registered Republican. I only seem liberal because I believe hurricanes are caused by high barometric pressure and not gay marriage.
Okay. So that's very funny. I was looking forward to hearing if you can say that kind of thing off the cuff in real life like your characters.
No, I really can't.
Are you ever a good quipper in real life?
I'm really not. I'm shy. I have a bit of a stammer. I tend to say when I want to say the right thing, I say the wrong thing. And so I've learned not to say much at all. And it's one of the reasons I enjoy writing.
A lot of the dialogue in The West Wing became known as the walk and talk, where two or more of the characters would be talking to each other, exchanging strategy or whatever, as they walk through the hall. And, you know, in reality, a lot of these conversations would probably be held behind closed doors as opposed to in the hallway. So how did the walk and talk come into being?
I'll tell you exactly how. First of all, I don't write a lot of action. My first movie was A Few Good Men, which was based on my first play. And there's a scene in the movie where Tom Cruise is in his car. He pulls his car over to the curb because he wants to hop out and buy a copy of Sports Illustrated at a newsstand. He does. He hops out. He buys the copy of Sports Illustrated at a newsstand. He gets back in his car. That is my action scene. And because there's very little of visual interest in what I write, visual interest has to be created. And it was created by Thomas Schlamme, my partner on The West Wing, the principal director of The West Wing, the guy who came up with the look for The West Wing. And it happened right off the bat in the pilot episode. What I had written was a series of scenes in different rooms in the White House, all involving John Spencer, who played Leo McGarry, the chief of staff. And Tommy came to me about 2 days before shooting began and said, listen, I want to walk you through something. because I'd like to try doing this in one, as it's called, in one continuous shot using a Steadicam, that Leo John Spencer can go from this room into this room, do this thing here, stop at Josh's office, walk through that corridor, come down here, do this here, and finally we sneak a peek at the Oval Office and we walk through here, and that was the day the Walk and Talk was born.
So there was a really funny parody of the Walk and Talk on 30 Rock, and you were in the scene.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
I want to play the scene, so let me give the setup. So Liz Lemon, played by Tina Fey, has just found out the show that she writes for is going to be put on hiatus. So she's applying for a writing position on a TV singing competition called The Sing Off, hosted by Nick Lachey, who became famous as a member of the boy band 98 Degrees. So while she's in the waiting room, waiting for this job interview, she's shocked to see you, Aaron Sorkin, waiting too. So here's the scene. Do I know you?
You know my work. Walk with me. I'm Aaron Sorkin. The West Wing, Few Good Men, The Social Network.
Studio 60.
Shut up. Do you know Nick Lachey? I hear he doesn't even let you sit in the meeting. He just screams at you to see how you react.
Wait, you're not really applying for this job, right?
Of course I am. You gotta take work where you can find it, especially now. Our craft is dying while people are playing Angry Birds and poking each other on Facebook. What is poking anyway? Why won't anybody do it to me? I'm cool.
So it's really that bad out there? I mean, you're Aaron Sorkin. Speaking of Angry Birds, do you know how to beat 11-4? It's just a red guy and a green guy.
Key is, do not use the green guy as a boomerang.
Do we just go in a circle?
Listen, lady, a gender I write extremely well if the story calls for it. This is serious. We make horse buggies, and the first Model T just rolled into town.
We're dinosaurs.
We don't need two metaphors. That's bad writing. Not that it matters.
Mr. Sorkin, Mr. Lachey will see you now.
Mr. Lachey, huge fan, huge fan. I have all your albums.
That's so funny.
Well, it was a lot of fun to do. It's a great group.
Did you write any of that yourself? Did you have any input?
Absolutely not. That script was written by Robert Carlock, who's great. I've played the jerk version of myself a couple of times, and I got to do it on Entourage, too.
So there's a line in there where she's giving all your credits, and she says, Studio 60, and you say, shut up.
Yeah, and that's actually the only tweak that I made, because I thought that Robert Carlock was trying to be a little too respectful of me. So I just pitched the line to Tina, who then went over to Robert, and everybody there laughed. So Tina came back and said, yeah, let's do that.
So we've just heard you're very good at playing yourself. You used to play other people as well. You started off as an actor before you became a writer. Is that what you really wanted to do when you were growing up, was to act?
I think saying that I started off as an actor might be misleading.
Should I say you started off trying to act?
I didn't even give it much of a try. When I was very little, all I wanted to be was an actor, and I acted in all the school plays, and I was the head of the drama club, and I acted in community theater. And then when I went to college, I auditioned for a conservatory program at Syracuse University and got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in, of all things, musical theater. I realized pretty early on that when everyone around me was learning how to act, for some reason what I was learning was what a play was. And I loved writing dialogue.
So you got your BA in musical theater. You loved musicals.
BFA. I have a Bachelor
of
Fine Arts.
Okay.
Yes, I have absolutely no liberal arts background at all, and really no higher education to speak of at all. Like I said, my 4 years of college was a conservatory training program in theater where we weren't allowed to take that many academic credits.
Do people expect that you will know the great books, and actually you don't?
Yeah, I am often mistaken for somebody who knows something, and I'm not. I create characters who know things, and I'm not just being self-deprecating. The reaction to The Newsroom has been polarized. There are a number of television critics who did not enjoy themselves watching the first four episodes, and I think that part of the reason is they think that I'm showing off an intellect and an erudition that I don't have. And just to be very clear, I'm not pretending to have it. I know that I don't have it. I phonetically create the sound of smart people talking to each other. I'm not one of them. The characters I create would have no use for me.
So we've established that you love musicals. and that, and just going back for a step, and that you have a degree in musical theater. Are you a good singer?
I'm awesome in the shower, but that's, I think I'm a good singer. I don't think anybody else would say that I am.
So I know for a while you did singing telegrams.
Yep.
What were the telegrams?
I worked for a company called the Witty Ditty Singing Telegram Company, and they would call you in the afternoon and say, you know, okay, I got a job for you. It's an anniversary. You're going to go to this fancy restaurant. Come here and get the lyrics, and it would just be set to the tune of a famous song. And you'd have to walk into a fancy restaurant holding a big thing of balloons, and you're in a red and white striped jacket with a straw boater and a kazoo. And even the songs themselves, you know, they would change two words of the song. It would be like, Rocky Mountain High, happy birthday. It was remarkably uncreative. And I even remember thinking, you know, is it okay if I maybe rewrite some of the song? But I didn't want to insult the person who wrote the song.
So you, I'm sure, learned a lot about playwriting and screenwriting from auditioning and from acting and seeing what worked and what didn't. Are there terrible lines that you had to read as an actor that made you think, this doesn't work? I am learning what does not work.
Yeah. Both when I was studying acting, I felt like this. There's just no way to make this line come out of my mouth and not seem ridiculous. So as a writer, I'm always conscious of that. And I'm very active when I'm writing. I'm playing the part. I'm saying it all out loud. I'm playing all the parts. I'm jumping up and down. And I want the lines to, at minimum, be speakable. You know, one of the lessons that I got in what works and what doesn't work, I was a bartender at Broadway theaters. I wrote A Few Good Men on cocktail napkins during the first act of La Cage aux Folles, and then came home and transposed it on a computer. But I would get to listen to plays every night without seeing them, plays that closed in a week and plays that ran for 2 years. You know, and I felt how an audience was responding to something. And I thought that was a really good lesson.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I'd love to talk more. But I want to, you know, congratulate you on the series getting renewed already.
Thanks very much.
The series being The Newsroom, the new HBO series. And just before we have to end, one more thing about The Newsroom. There's a couple of scenes where after the Jeff Daniels character, the anchor of the new show, does an interview that's especially good, the producers in the control room applaud, or they nearly have like tears in their eyes because it's so good. And I wish I could tell you that my producers in the control room were applauding right now, or that they had tears streaming down their cheeks. They kind of don't.
I'm looking in your control room right now, and they're beside that. They can't control themselves. They're either happy, they're emotional of some kind. I can't hear what's happening, but I can see. And they're extremely emotional.
I think you're creating false expectations for me. I can't measure up.
No. I can't even describe what's happening here, nor can I take a picture of it because they make you turn your cell phone off when you're in the studio. But if you could see what was going on here, you'd be really proud.
Aaron Sorkin, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's really
so
good to
much.
Talk to you, Terry. Thanks.
Aaron Sorkin speaking with Terry Gross. Sorkin created and writes the new HBO series, The Newsroom. As a newspaper columnist, interviewer, and author, Catlin Moran is well known in England and has earned a bunch of awards. Her book, How to Be a Woman, is out in America this week, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says Moran's book is a must-read for anyone curious to find out just how very funny a self-proclaimed strident feminist can be.
Funny feminists should never die. There are too few of them who've gained any cultural prominence in the first place. That's why Nora Ephron's death earlier this summer flattened me, even though I hadn't read her in a while and had mixed feelings about the whole I feel bad about my neck self-flagellation routine. Still, she made me laugh at the same time she often made me think. I wanted her playing on Team Feminists forever. I don't mean to give the impression that Catlin Moran is some mid-game replacement, but it is bracing in this season of losing Ephron to discover a younger feminist writer who scrimmages with the patriarchy and drop-kicks zingers with comic flair. Moran is a 30-something-year-old columnist for the London Times, and her book, newly published here, was a bestseller when it came out in Britain last year. Called How to Be a Woman, it's a collection of essays that constitutes a rough memoir. Moran was the oldest of eight children, raised in subsidized housing in Wolverhampton, which seems to be one of those places the Queen dutifully visits and then skedaddles out of before nightfall. Moran was indifferently homeschooled from the age of 11, and like many a lonely misfit before her, turned to books for company. Germaine Greer became her guiding feminist divinity, and in fact, Moran says that when she started writing this book, she wanted it to be like The Female Eunuch, but with jokes about my knickers. Roseanne Barr, at her sassy prime, is probably the closest American analog to Moran. Like Roseanne, Catelyn Moran is salty. I can't quote vast swaths of her language. But more importantly, like Roseanne used to do, Moran invests her consciousness-raising confessions with an all-too-rare working-class worldview. The image Moran presents of herself in the opening essay is one that's not easily forgotten. It's the spring of 1988, and it's Moran's birthday. She's just turned 13 and is an aficionado of the gender-bending style of Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders. Moran is wearing Wellington boots and a man's army coat. She weighs in at 182 pounds and is running because she's being chased by a pack of boys hurling stones at her. She does not think the yobs, as she calls them, are interested in her emerging femininity. I do not, Moran says, look very feminine. Diana, Princess of Wales, is feminine. I am feminine. That scene sets the tone for what follows, as Moran races through the milestones of womanhood, hilariously hurling back challenges to traditional gender expectations. In a hoot of an essay called I Become Furry, Moran recalls the momentous sprouting of her pubic hair. She then uses that memory as an occasion to ruminate on what she calls contemporary pube disapproval, as evidenced by the pressure to wax away all offending hair. Moran snorts, I can't believe we've got to a point where it's basically costing us money to have a vagina. They're making us pay for maintenance and upkeep of our lulus like they're a communal garden. It's a stealth tax. This is money we should be spending on the electricity bill and cheese and berets. Current trends in personal grooming aside, most of the other topics Moran tackles in How to Be a Woman constitute a hit parade from the last 40 or so years of feminist writing. Sexuality, marriage, division of housework, female body fat, abortion, and sexism in the workplace. As Moran notes, however, feminism seems to be in remission among the young. All the more reason to revisit, with gusto, some of the familiar battleground issues. Moran, who proudly cops to being a strident feminist, offers this challenge to those women readers on the fence about feminism. Here, Moran says, is the quick way of working out if you're a feminist. A. Do you have a vagina? And B. Do you want to be in charge of it? If you said yes to both questions, Moran says, then congratulations, you're a feminist.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed How to Be a Woman by Catelyn Moran. Coming up, Sigourney Weaver talks about playing another strong female lead in the new USA miniseries Political Animals. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, actress Sigourney Weaver, has made a career of playing strong, accomplished women. Her latest role casts her as a player in national politics in the new USA Network series Political Animals. Weaver plays a former first lady whose husband, a charming Southern politician, was caught in sex scandals. After leaving the White House, Weaver's character runs unsuccessfully for president, divorces her husband, and becomes Secretary of State. The series explores Weaver's character's family life, as well as her diplomatic efforts, her dealings with journalists, and her political ambitions. Sigourney Weaver has been nominated 3 times for Academy Awards. She's probably best known for playing the character Ellen Ripley in 4 Alien movies. Among her many other films are The Year of Living Dangerously, Gorillas in the Mist, The Ice Storm, Ghostbusters, and Avatar. We began our conversation with the scene from the first episode of Political Animals. Weaver's character Elaine Hammond Barish has just conceded defeat in the presidential primary and is speaking with her husband, the former president, Bud Hammond, played by Kieran Hines.
I know, given your epic levels of narcissism, that it's impossible for you to fathom this loss has nothing to do with you, but imagine for a moment that it doesn't. The country loves you, Bud. They will always love you. It's me they have mixed feelings about.
Now, sugar.
Please don't give me that crap about how the people would love me if they just knew me. It's been 20 years, okay? They know me. I hate campaigning. It's an Olympic sport in hypocrisy. Fat smokers droning on and on about their medical coverage, smiling when babies with runny noses are shoved in my face. And most of all, I hate lying. I hate lying and telling people that things are going to get better when they never will. You believe the lie, and that is why you have won every election you've ever been in. And that's why Garcetti is going to win, too.
Boo.
That man is going to be elected president, and if you don't get in line, you are going to be iced out.
I left office with an 84% approval rating. I am the most popular Democrat since Kennedy had his brain splattered across the Dallas concrete. Baby, I am the meat in the Big Mac of this party. The white, creamy center of its Oreo freaking cookie and that greasy Michael Corleone knockoff needs me to win this son of a bitch, plain and simple.
You bastard. It's the hardest moment of my professional life, and you can't even pretend to make this easier for me.
Sigourney Weaver, welcome back to Fresh Air. Have you ever worked in a political campaign, ever been drawn to that world at all?
I have. I worked on Capitol Hill when I was in college. I worked for a Republican congressman. I was in charge of his gun control correspondence. He sent out one letter to people who were vehemently for gun control and a very similar but significantly different letter to the people who were against it. And at that same summer, I was also campaigning for Nelson Rockefeller, for whom my father ran the campaigns. So I had one very political summer, and since then, you know, I consider my vote probably my most important possession as a woman and as a citizen. So I'm not in politics. That summer made me a little cynical about the whole thing, but I'm still a believer.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people, young people who are exposed to politics and Washington, you know, just become addicted and want to make a life of it. You didn't.
No, I didn't. But I actually was very interested in journalism at the time and am still somewhat surprised that I didn't end up in that.
Did you draw on Hillary Clinton or anybody else in preparing for this role?
You know, I think a large part of Greg Berlanti's thinking was that we've had 3 remarkable women who've been our secretaries of state, but somehow we're not willing as a country to elect a woman president. And I think that this show partially investigates what that's about. I was actually inspired by a lot of the men and women in my life who've, to me, been very inspiring, who have a real moral compass, who have the big picture in mind no matter what they're doing, and a lot of them running nonprofits. So although I certainly admire Mrs. Clinton, I could not begin to draw on her except very superficially because I don't know her and I really don't know much about her. So I think there are similarities in our facts, but the show is inspired by a lot of the families who've been in the White House and who want to get back in the White House, not just the Clintons, but the Johnsons, the Kennedys, the Roosevelts, the Bushes. You know, it does something to a family to be in the White House, especially to the kids. And these people often want to get back in the White House, and that's why we have these political dynasties who Greg feels are as close as America gets to having royalty.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask, were you ever at the White House? I read a story about you visiting the White House in the 1980s.
I did. I visited the White House in 1984.
What do you remember about
it? The Reagan White House. Well, it was, you know, they did a beautiful job. It was a very glamorous Christmas evening with a lot of princes from Saudi Arabia. And I guess I was handpicked to sit next to this little 11-year-old Saudi prince who was in love with Ghostbusters and probably Zool. And and I took the opportunity to try to speak to the president about women's reproductive rights. And that conversation was curtailed very quickly by people who removed me from him and lifted me, as I recall, forcibly, but gently, you know, in a polite kind of way, away from the receiving line. And I just thought, well, that's too bad because, you know, he's our president. He's my president. I may not have voted for him, but still, we have a right to have a dialogue about this. And so on the one hand, I was very moved by being in the White House and meeting the president and the first lady and seeing the welcome they had, you know, put out. But at the same time, it was like kind of a farce, I thought.
This is hard to believe. I mean, Sigourney Weaver, I mean, you were a prominent actress at this point. You're speaking to the president and someone bodily removes you?
Well, I was speaking to the president, but he wasn't speaking back. He was standing there looking at me. You know, and I think I just wanted to have a conversation with him for about 2 minutes and have him say, you know, I am thinking about this and I am aware of what you're talking about. And I do think that it's a difficult moral area for me and I'm still nothing. It was not allowed that I would have that conversation. Now, heavens knows, you know, it could happen in a Democratic White House too, but I doubt that it would have happened with the Clintons. I bet they would have just gone, yeah, we want more of that. Let's mix it up.
Well, I don't know if there's ever been a Sigourney Weaver interview that didn't mention Ellen Ripley of the Alien series, and this isn't going to be one of them, but I wanted to play a clip from the first one, Alien. I guess, God, what were you, 29 years old when you did that role, something like that?
28.
Okay, and this is a moment where you're the warrant officer on this spaceship that's landed on a planet, and a creature has attached itself to one of your crew members who's out on the planet, and he and other crew members are concerned. They want to get back in the spaceship. You control the hatch, and here's what happens.
Hey, Ripley.
Right here.
We're clean. Let us in.
What happened to Kane?
Something has attached itself to him. We have to get him to the infirmary right away.
What kind of thing? I need a clear definition.
An organism. Open the hatch.
Wait a minute. If we let it in, the ship could be infected. You know the quarantine procedure.
24 hours for decontamination.
It could die in 24 hours. Open the hatch.
Listen to me. If we break quarantine, we could all die.
Look, could you open the goddamn hatch? We have to get him inside.
No.
I can't do that. And if you were in my position, you'd do the same.
Ripley, this is an order. Open that hatch right now. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Ripley, this is an order. You hear me?
Yes. I read you. The answer is negative.
And thank heavens the science, evil science officer did open the hatch. The monster got in, ate the crew, and your career really took off.
There you go.
Of course, our guest Sigourney Weaver playing Ellen Ripley in Alien.
She's a tough cookie.
You know, I know that when you were on the show before, you talked about how this you had done a lot of acting in theater. You kind of weren't expecting to get this role, and Ridley Scott directed it. But it must have really changed your life.
Yeah, of course it did. You know, I was incredibly lucky, but it was not really part of my career plan. I wanted to do like Shakespeare, and if I had to do a movie, you know, maybe a little Woody Allen movie, but nothing more than that.
Now, in the second one of the series, Aliens, which was directed by James Cameron and for which you got an Oscar nomination, there's this incredibly dramatic scene at the end where you confront the alien and you're wearing this sort of big power suit that allows you to operate these huge pinchers and appendages and battle the alien. And what's interesting, this was before computer-generated graphics. This mm-hmm. all had to be done at the time with real models. It's incredibly gripping. And I wonder, was it scary at times?
Well, you know, I used to practice during the lunch hour climbing into this contraption. There was a giant man named John who actually was inside the power loader. And he and I would practice walking and moving. You did really have to practice because we didn't have CGI. And I think it looks better. I did have help John, the secret behind me, but it's pretty much me calling the shots as Ripley, you know, in the fight.
Right, and the scenes where the monster comes within inches of your face and is dripping acid from its jowls and these sharp teeth, was this at all terrifying? You know, I think of like Janet Leigh and Psycho and how she never took a standing shower again after she saw that
yeah.
film. Was this in any way real or scary at the time?
You know, I have to say that I was so, I can certainly understand about the shower. I think she gave us all that terror forever. But I think in this case, Ripley is so determined to save that little girl, Newt, that, it, you know, all I remember is just the kind of heat of the passion of getting rid of this other mother. You know, I mean, it was really mother to mother. And I had killed all of her eggs, which was, I have to say, probably the most satisfying moment in that whole movie.
The alien's egg nest, yeah.
The alien's egg nest. You know, after I'd made a deal to protect them, kind of, even though we weren't speaking, we were kind of speaking. So, yes, it was a big battle, you know, and I think James Cameron meant it to be the battle of the sort of Titan mothers. But I was not afraid. First of all, we weren't using real acid. We were using KY jelly. So I probably got whacked in the face with a few squirts of KY. But at that point, it was, you know, I was so filthy, covered with muck in so many ways, and I'd been shooting this for so long. I was, you know, half Ripley at that point, you know.
Now, you reunited with James Cameron much more recently in Avatar. Let's hear one clip from Avatar. I mean, you play Grace Augustine. She's a biologist, and, you know, you're working on this planet where a big corporation wants to get the natives, the Na'vi, out of the way so they can harvest this precious ore. And this is sort of late in the struggle where you're arguing with one of the mining people, played by Giovanni Ribisi, and I think a military guy, played by Stephen Lang, and they essentially want to destroy the planet to get the ore. You're giving them a different perspective. Let's listen.
Parker, there is time to salvage the situation. Parker,
shut your pie hole.
Or what? Ranger Rick, you gonna shoot me?
I can do that.
You need to muzzle your dog.
Yeah, can we just take this down a couple of notches, please?
Those trees were sacred to the Omotikai in a way you can't imagine.
You know what? You throw a stick in the air around here, it's gonna land on some sacred fern, for Christ's sake.
I'm not talking about some kind of pagan voodoo here. I'm talking about something real, something measurable in the biology of the forest.
Which is what exactly?
What we think we know is that there is some kind of electrochemical communication between the roots of the trees, like the synapses between neurons. And each tree has 10 to the fourth connections to the trees around it. And there are 10 to the 12th trees on Pandora.
Which is a lot, I'm guessing.
It's more connections than the human brain. Get it? It's a network. It's a global network, and the Na'vi can access it. They can upload and download data, memories, at sites like the one you just destroyed.
That's our guest, Sigourney Weaver. This film is different because in addition to the character, the human character you play, you have an avatar, this, 9-foot-tall representation of yourself that's blue and has a tail. And you do that part of the shoot with this performance capture technology where you wear a black Lycra suit or something. You want to just talk a little bit about how that's different from the kind of acting that you normally do?
Well, the way Jim Cameron does performance capture, and he's the only one who calls it that, you have actors like myself in a kind of black little cat suit with little ears and a tail in our case because we're doing Avatar. We are in a big empty room that's filled with cameras and computers. And what Jim is doing is trying to capture, like quickfire, a great master where all the relationships are perfect. So in other words, it's like an early rehearsal of a play where you don't have props and you don't have costumes, but it's all about the connections between people. Now, he could come back in when none of the actors were there and do all the close-ups, 2 shots, 3 shots. Everything had been absorbed about that first perfect master by the computers. So it actually revolutionized filmmaking, and it also revolutionized it in a very actor-centric way. That's why he calls it performance capture. It's not about our voicing these big blue people. It's about taking the essence of what the actor is doing and translating that into, in this case, 3D and computer graphic images of another race in space. I just want actors listening to know that, because actors are absolutely essential to this process. It's not like this stuff is going to replace us. It's sourced with the actor and the human heart.
So what took you into acting?
Well, when I was at college, I was an English major. And on the side, I did a lot of very irreverent, crazy theater with a wonderful group called The Company. You know, we were fearless and we had nothing to do with any drama department. And when it came time for me to leave college, which is a scary moment, I quickly applied to drama schools, kind of as a lark, and I got in. Now,
to Yale.
I actually, to all of them, actually. Then I had a miserable time at Yale where they really were discouraging.
Hmm. In what way?
They told me I had no talent and I'd never get anywhere. You know, I am not alone. So many art schools believe that they need to tear down young people. They consider it a sort of rite of passage to kind of steamroll you and crush you into the dust. And so that's why I helped found the Flea Theater here in New York, where we have 90 young actors, brilliant, wonderful young actors, very diverse. We just got a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts. But so actually, it's a good thing it happened to me that Yale was so mean, because now I've been part of something that's created an alternative to drama school, which is you come into the theater and you learn by doing. And I work at the Flea and we all inspire each other.
Well, Sigourney Weaver, it's been great to have you back. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure. I'm a huge fan of the show and of NPR in general.
Sigourney Weaver's new TV series, Political Animals, is shown Sundays on the USA Network. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer was Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.